thank you, Bob. I'm delighted to be here. During my 24 years at Cornell, it has been my great pleasure to work as a faculty member and administrator with three great presidents and five great provosts, and I'm delighted to see Hunter and Frank here today, and Keith and Don. I've only gotten to know Dale Corson well over the last 5 or 6 years. After I became a vice president, I would run into Dale at dinners, which we were both invited to. And I have to say that I've learned more at those dinners than I had at practically anything. Now, as I said, I've been here for 24 years, and although faculty members are not supposed to show weakness, I have to tell you that for 22 years, I've had a recurring nightmare. I will wake up practically every night in the middle of the night in a cold sweat, and okay, it's just a nightmare, and I go back to sleep. Today, when I woke up, I realized it wasn't just a nightmare. I had to follow Frank Rhodes. Bob, I'm going to get even with you someday. Okay. Well, let me talk about why tuition keeps rising at selective private institutions. Over 30 years ago, a young labor economist at Princeton named Bill Bowen, who unfortunately could not be here today, studied data from a set of selective private universities during the period roughly 1900 to 1960. And he concluded that tuition had been rising at these institutions on average about 2 to 3% more than inflation a year. Some years it had been rising more, some years it had been rising less. And he attributed this increase partially to the increased specialization of knowledge, partially to the growth of new graduate programs and fields of study. But first and foremost, he attributed to the fact that the nature of the educational process in selective institutions does not permit academia to share in the productivity gains that were leading to the growth of real earnings in the rest of the economy. And put simply, at our institutions, the number of students that the average faculty member teaches each year typically doesn't change, because we value low student-teacher ratios, and we feel that they are essential to high-quality education. And so to avoid a decline in faculty members' real earnings, since faculty members were not generating more revenue by educating more students, it was necessary to raise tuition by more than inflation. Because if the universities had failed to do this, and the relative earnings position of faculty had declined over time, it would be very difficult to retain faculty and to encourage new people to go into the field. Now, fortunately, during the 1900-1960 period, on average, real incomes of families were increasing during the period because of both the real wage growth due to productivity gains and also due to the fact that increasingly women were coming into the labor force and their earnings were increasing family income. So as a result, tuition, although it was going up by more than inflation, did not rise by more than family income during most of the period. Now, in recent years, tuition has similarly continued to increase by more than inflation. However, during the 1980s, real income growth in the United States stagnated. And as a result, tuition growing by more than inflation meant that tuition as a share of family income was increasing. So this figure illustrates the point for Cornell University, but the story is the same for all selective private institutions in the nation. Between 1966 and 1967 and 1979-80, Cornell's endowed tuition remained roughly 26 to 28% of median family income. And in fact, during the period, at least during part of the period, we had a policy of increasing tuition by median family income growth each year. However, by 1992-93, this ratio had risen to 49%. During the 1990s, median family income began to grow again in real terms, and the ratio then stabilized at this new higher level of about 49%. However, the damage had been done. The concern by the public that college costs were taking a greater share of the typical family's income was magnified by the rapid run-up in endowments that occurred during the booming stock market of the 1990s. And families wondered, why did the selective institutions even raise tuition at all? Now, what I'm going to do today is I'm going to claim that there are a set of forces, in addition to the ones that Bill Bowen discussed, that continue to put upward pressure on tuition. These include the aspirations of academic institutions, our winner-take-all society, the shared system of governance that exist in the selective institutions, recent federal government policies, the role of external actors such as alumni, local governments, and the environmental movement and historic preservationists, periodicals that rank academic institutions, and how the universities are organized for budgetary purposes and select and reward their deans. And I'm just going to briefly discuss these forces. If you want to have a more complete discussion, you'll have to look at my forthcoming being next year, Harvard University Press book, which I've decided to call Tuition Fever because my colleague Bob Frank's book, Luxury Fever, has done so well. And after discussing each of these forces, I will conclude with some steps that academic institutions themselves must take if they want to hold down their cost. So let us begin. The objective of our institutions are to be the very best that we can in every aspect of our activities. And I like to use the analogy that we are very much like Cookie Monsters. Now, remember, Cookie Monster is the character on Sesame Street who goes around searching for all the cookies he can and then immediately stuffs them in his mouth. Well, we are like that. We aggressively seek out all the resources that we can find and put them to use funding things that we think will make us better. We want better facilities, better faculty, improved research support, improved instructional technology, and better students. Now, all of these things, unfortunately, take more money. And while the selective universities could aggressively try to increase their efficiency, reduce cost, and get better by substitution rather than growing expenditures, they don't do this for a number of reasons that I'm going to stress. Rather, they adopt the attitude that as long as there are long lines of high-quality students flocking to our doors and accepting our offers of admission, there is no reason for them to moderate their tuition increases. And flock to our doors, the students do. The fraction of our nation's top students, as measured by test scores or grade point averages, that choose to enroll in the selective private universities has been going up substantially over time. The development of need-blind admissions and need-based financial aid played a role in this change. So did reductions in transportation and communication cost. Now, more recently, the increased income inequality in the United States has caused students and their families to be preoccupied with, and again in my colleague Bob Frank's terms, buying the best. And my own research with several of my former students suggests that this is a wise thing to do because we show that the economic returns to attending a selective private institution rather than other private institutions are large, and not only are they large, but they have been increasing. The relative advantage of coming to an institution like Cornell has been increasing each time, over time. So if students and their parents are buying the best, it's very essential for each selective institution to want to remain in the subset of schools that are considered the best. So each winds up in an arms race of spending to make itself look better relative to its competitors. The spending is not restricted to the academic part of the institution. Institutions compete with new athletic facilities, including fitness centers, new resident halls, and improved dining facilities. Actually, we don't have new dining facilities. We have new dining kiosks, right? That's the term. And if Duke has a freshman campus, then Cornell had better have a freshman campus also. Their quest to be the best is true in graduate education and research as well as it is in other areas. It is much easier to remain at the top or near the top nationwide in a field than it is to strengthen a weak field and achieve a high level of distinction. As a result, at Cornell, we swallow hard as the cost of conducting research in the physical sciences and engineering rise rapidly, and this is a point I'm going to come back to in a moment, and we continue to heavily devote our resources to these fields in which the university has traditionally excelled. Pity the poor university that finds that to maintain its excellence in sciences and engineering, it has to skimp in other areas, such as faculty salaries, and continue to raise tuition at a rate that exceeds inflation. Okay, let's move on now and talk about shared governance, because this really is one of the important forces. Why selective private universities fail to consider the option of reducing their cost rather than raising tuition to find the revenue that is necessary to enhance their operations derives to a large extent from how they are governed. The system of shared governance between trustees, administrators, and faculty almost guarantee that they will be slow to react to cost pressures. Now let's start off talking about trustees. One of my best jobs, one of the things that was really the most fun about my job was meeting the Cornell trustees when I was an administrator, because these really are super people. And trustees are usually successful business people. They know how to cut costs and to meet budget constraints. However, if the president of a university, such say hypothetically like Cornell, tells them that they need to spend money for new initiatives in genomics, in information science, and advanced materials to maintain the strength of the university and keep it at the forefront of science and engineering, they're likely to swallow hard and go along with him. If the president similarly says that they need funding to enhance the living and learning environment of the university, it's a wonderful thing, and of course they're going to go along with him also. Now, there is, however, an important distinction between the trustees of public and private institutions, and some background data will help to make this point clear. If you look at the figure, in 1978-79, the average full professor at public doctorate-granting universities earned about 91% of what his or her peer at private doctorate universities earned. This ratio fell steadily during the 1980s and early 1990s until it stabilized at about 78 to 80%. So this fall in the public universities' relative salaries made it difficult for the publics to hire and retain top faculty and invariably led to some decline in their academic quality. Similarly, between 1988 and 1994, state appropriations to public higher education per full-time student fell in real terms by 10%, did not keep up with inflation. While tuition increases made up for part of this decline, in real terms, spending per student fell at many state institutions. During the same period of time, expenditures per student in real terms were relentlessly increasing at the selective privates. So the disparity of the funding of the two institutions was growing. So now we have to ask, do these data suggest that the trustees of public institutions care less about the quality of their institutions than do the trustees of private institutions? In most cases, the answer is no, although in some states, including New York, there are people who have serious questions about the trustees' goals. However, unlike private university trustees, public university trustees do not have final control over the tuition levels that their institutions charge or their state appropriation often. The political process makes the appropriation decision, and the political process often makes the tuition decision. Now, in New York State, in fact, the tuition decision formally is made by the trustees, not the political process. However, if the governor of the state lets the trustees know that he wants tuition held constant, it would be foolhardy for the trustees not to accede to his wishes. Because if they did not, they would risk losing their positions. And they would also face the possibility that the political process could react and penalize them by reducing state appropriations by the amount of income that they were going to raise by their increased tuitions. So as a result, no matter what the trustees feel and what their goals are, the budgets in public institutions have been cut in spite of trustee concerns. So faced with these tight budgets, and of course this derives from the fact that there are other competing needs which state governments face, including reducing income taxes, more funds for welfare, health care, and the criminal justice system, administrators at public institutions, including, and I'm including here the statutory colleges at Cornell, make hard decisions and take the necessary steps to balance their budgets. They can always blame the cut on the state, okay, and their faculty do not blame them personally. In contrast, if the administrators at the selective private institutions were to recommend budget cutbacks, all blame would be assigned to them. They would be widely accused by the faculty of not making a strong enough case to the trustees of the need for higher tuition to maintain institutional quality. Rather than risk losing the support of the faculty, the typical president and provost will swallow hard and recommend raising tuition by more than they really want to do it. After all, administrative terms are not that long, and once an administrator loses the support of the faculty, in most cases, it is very, very difficult to effectively lead the institution. Now, why is the support of the faculty so important? Well, the answer is that under our system of shared governance, the faculty rules supreme on academic matters. The faculty also feels that it should play a major role in all other decisions at the university. And to achieve faculty support for projects is often expensive, both in terms of time and dollars. At Cornell, for example, the estimated cost of a major new advanced materials research facility has risen from $40 million to $53 million because of the modifications in the building that were needed to win faculty support for where the university wanted to site the building. Now, these modifications were all good things, okay? It was sort of atria to improve the college's environment and improve classrooms. However, the modification had nothing to do with the underlying academic research program for which the building was constructed. Okay, we are up now to the federal government. In recent years, the federal government has contributed to cost pressure at universities and private universities in at least three ways. First, the consent decree that the Ivy League colleges entered into after being faced with an antitrust suit in the early 90s prevents these institutions from meeting to discuss the financial need of individual students before financial aid offers are made. While these institutions can and have agreed to base financial aid only on financial need, each is now free to determine need as it sees fit. This has led to the increased use of a practice that has become known in the popular press as dialing for dollars, which is to say that accepted applicants simply call up an institution and say, your financial aid offer isn't as good as the financial aid offer that I've gotten elsewhere. What are you going to do about it? In some cases, some schools actually encourage you to do this. Carnegie Mellon University invites all admitted students to let them know if they get better financial aid packages elsewhere so that the university can consider if it wants to do something about it. Well, it's quite clear to me, at least, that the consent decree has led to enhanced financial competition for students and therefore improved financial aid packages. Now, where does the money from improved financial aid packages come from? It comes from increased annual giving, increased payout from endowment, increased endowment for financial aid, and increased tuition. The richest institutions have been able to finance their improved programs out of an increased payout from endowment. However, for most selective private institutions, increased financial aid has required at least some additional recycled tuition revenue. And it does that because even if you succeed in raising more endowment and more annual giving for scholarship money, some of this is money that would have come to the university for other purposes, so you have to make that up out of the general tuition budget. Secondly, federal government has contributed to increasing our costs through the way it funds the Basic Educational Opportunity Grant. The maximum BEOG grant put simply, has not kept up with inflation. Viewed in constant 1997 dollars, the maximum BR grant rose from $1,500 at the program's inception to over $4,000 in 1975. And since that date, it declined considerably after falling to under $2,500 in the mid-1990s. It rebounded to $2,700 in 1997 and is scheduled to be somewhat over $3,000 next year. This failure of the BR grant, or the Pell Grant, to keep up with inflation, let alone tuition, which remember is always going up at rates 2 to 3% more than inflation, caused the private institutions to dig deeper into their pockets for financial aid funds, and increasingly financial aid funds have become an institutional priority, putting more pressure on tuition. Now finally, and here I'm going to alienate further all of the scientists in the audience, I'd like you to focus on the second column in the upper left-hand panel. The cost of doing research at the selective private universities has increased in recent years as the federal government has put pressure on the private universities to reduce their indirect cost rates. And this is all as a result of the experience at Stanford, which we can discuss at another time. Between fiscal year 1990 and fiscal year 1997, the mean indirect cost rate at the 39 largest private universities fell from 62% to 56%. Now remember, indirect cost recoveries are recoveries for expenditures that the university is making on research infrastructure and research administration. If you indirect cost rate goes down, you have a choice, and the choice is you can cut your expenditures or you can increasingly pay for these expenditures out of your own funds. Our experience at Cornell was even worse. Our indirect cost rate fell from 75% in fiscal year 1970 to 61% in 1967. In addition to the decline, so Cornell's decline in indirect cost rates was much worse than the decline in indirect cost rates at the typical private university, because we were a high indirect cost rate institution, and that's a very important point. In addition, the federal agencies began to put more pressure on all institutions to provide matching funds in grant applications. At the same time that direct cost funding levels were often being reduced for large center grants, matching fund expectations were growing. And Cornell has found numerous times that to win a renewal of a major research center grant at the same or a smaller level of funding usually requires the institution to ante up more in matching funds. Now, where do the funds to make up for the loss of indirect cost rate recoveries and the need to contribute matching funds come from? They come from the general operating budgets of the university. And this, too, puts increased pressure on tuition. And this increased pressure was especially true at universities that are relatively science-intensive, that face the largest reduction in indirect cost, and that have relatively small endowments per student. And I will give you a guess as to how Cornell fits those characteristics. Okay, we're going to move on now to talk about external actors. Alumni the first. We love our alumni. Our alumni are vital to the institution. They help recruit students for us. They interview students. They encourage students to come to the university. They provide internship experiences for students. They help place the students in permanent jobs. They come and lecture to our classes. They provide extern experiences during the January break. And they also provide donations to us. Now, and so alumni are wonderful, right? But the alumni, unfortunately, also have strong preferences, what should be valued by the university. And by strongly communicating these preferences and threatening to withhold contributions, they discourage institutions from cutting almost anything. Similarly, and we can sort of talk of all sorts of examples, from athletics to specific academic programs. That's just a fact of life. Similarly, they occasionally provide gifts that the academic institutions really don't want because they will add to rather than reducing our cost. And it is a rare president who refuses such a gift. Bill Bowen told me, and I'm sorry that he's not here to verify this, that in all of his years at Princeton, he did it exactly once. And he was very proud that he did it once because he felt that most presidents never did it. I mean, we don't want to alienate alumni because of the fact that we don't want this gift, but maybe we will want the next gift. And in addition, the alumni have friends, and if they tell their friends that they're being mistreated by the university, it's a very difficult situation. We also face cost pressure from local governments and interest groups such as environmentalists and historic preservationists. The selective private institutions are always adding new facilities and renovating old ones, and to obtain required construction permits from local governments requires complex discussions and negotiations. Ultimately, these discussions may lead the institution to make increased financial payments to local governments to compensate for the institution's tax-exempt status. And there was a recent story in the Chronicle of Higher Education, for example, that discussed how much Harvard had to increase its payments to the city of Boston to enable it to develop properties that it owned in the city. Pressures from environmentalists and historic preservationists typically slow down our projects and increase our costs by much more than similar pressures would increase the cost for for-profit firms. Unlike business firms, most academic institutions do not have the option of packing up and moving to a new location. So we can't hold that knife over the head of the people who are threatening it. Cornell is not going to leave Ithaca. Also, since the institutions are either public bodies or nonprofits that receive favorable tax treatment under the law, they're expected to make decisions that are in the public interest. For example, Cornell's plan to build a new incinerator to dispose of toxic waste has been held up, by my count now, by over 4 years as the institution tries to assuage the concern of environmentalists. Now, what have we been doing? We've been trucking the waste to other sites. It has to be more expensive to truck it to other sites, otherwise that would have been the preferred solution. Similarly, Yale recently announced that it was abandoning plans to demolish several antiquated buildings that comprised its divinity school because it believed the cost in terms of time and money of fighting the battle and the cost was simply going to be too prohibitive. Okay, this leads us now to the role of the rankings systems. Now, we've always had ranking systems of universities, at least as far back as my life. Barron's ranking of colleges is now probably in its 30th edition. But what Barron's and the other long-term ranking systems did was to group institutions into wide categories. So if Cornell was listed in the same category as 20 other prestigious institutions, that was fine for us. However, now we have U.S. News and World Report, where we get a specific numerical ranking. And when these numerical rankings influence potential students' perceptions of the quality of the institutions, no matter how much the institutions criticize the rankings, they have reasons to fear that the rankings may influence students' behavior. And a recent study that I conducted with a colleague at the Consortium for Financing Higher Education showed that, in fact, this fear was justified. Because what we found, using data from 30 selective private institutions over an 11-year period, was that the changes in the rankings do influence admission outcomes and financial aid bills. When an institution's rank improves, more students apply to it the next year. The institution could be more selective and admit a smaller fraction of its applicants. Of the people you admit, a greater fraction of the students will come, their test scores will be higher, and you don't have to give as much grant aid in need-based financial aid packages to get them to come. Conversely, when your ranking falls, bad things happen. So as a result, institutions take actions to try to positively influence their rankings. And to the extent that rankings are associated, at least partially, with how much the university is spending per student, no administrator in his or her right mind would take actions to unilaterally reduce the institution's expenditures unless he or she was forced to by the trustees. And you can imagine how the members of the Cornell Board of Trustees Finance Committee reacted once when I was at a finance committee meeting and they were saying, we have to aggressively reduce cost. And I said, we're going to fall in the U.S. News and World Report ranking if you do that. So the rankings do matter, and it sort of prevents the institution from taking, even if it wanted to reduce costs, it would be crazy for the institution to do so because it would penalize them. Okay, let's move to the final thing that I want to talk about, which is how the universities organize themselves and for budgetary purposes and how they select and reward their deans. And I've discussed these issues in detail elsewhere, so I'm going to just give you a cursory summary of some of the key points here. Simply put, there are four broad types of resource allocation methodologies that we could use at a university. The first, central control, and when you think of central control, I want you to think of an institution such as Princeton. In this type of system, all of the revenue, with the possible exception of some external gifts and direct cost on external research grants, flows directly to the central administration. The central administration covers its cost, and then it allocates some portion of the remaining revenue back to the individual colleges. The second model is a TUB model, or sometimes it's called a resource center method model. And you should think of Harvard here. Here, each college is treated as a TUB on its own bottom. It keeps all of its tuition and other sources of revenue. It pays money to the central administration only to cover its share of the central cost. And it's responsible for all of its costs, including facilities, maintenance, and operations. The third model, which is TUBS with a franchise fee, and here I want you to think of you can think of the University of Pennsylvania. Here, each college is treated as a TUB on its own bottom, but it sends more money to the center that is needed to cover the center's cost, and the center has a pool of funds available to send back to the colleges in a discretionary sense. You can sort of think of this as a franchise fee. Each college pays a franchise fee for belonging to the university, and the franchise fee is then allocated back to the various colleges through some priority setting process. And then the final type of model, which is the model that is currently employed at University of Michigan, each college remits to the center a share of its expenditures. This share is not based upon cost, but it's an agreed upon percentage. The percentage may differ depending upon the activities, so you may give back more for your tuition revenue than you do for your off-campus programs. And it's structured in such a way that, again, the center gets more revenue than it needs to cover center cost, and it has funds to reallocate back to the colleges. Now, the benefits of a pure responsibility center model, Model 2, including the incentives that are present for units to maximize their resources and to manage them prudently, is well known. However, in a number of my writings, I have argued that an unwarranted side effect of such an approach is that it reduces the incentive for individual colleges to collaborate and to take actions that are in the best interest of the institution as a whole. Put another way, what makes economic sense for individual units does not necessarily help to reduce duplication and hold down costs for the university as a whole. Now, who owns an institution's endowment is an important dimension of institutional control. The individual colleges at one private research university that I visited last year and whose president spoke here yesterday keep all of their tuition revenue. So at first glance, this institution appears to be organized as a set of TUBs. However, the university as a whole has a large endowment which is owned primarily by the central administration. As a result, the provost is able to heavily influence the behavior of the individual units through his control of the allocation of endowment spending. At Cornell, by the way, most of the endowments are owned by the colleges, and three of the colleges, which we call the general purpose colleges, arts and sciences, art, architecture, and planning, and engineering, are centrally controlled, and all of the other colleges, the professional schools, law, business, and hotel, as well as the statutory colleges, are TUBs. So in a budgetary sense, the center of the university has very little control over many of the colleges. And then a final factor that determines whether the center can influence the college behavior is how the deans are appointed and evaluated. At many institutions, committees of primarily faculty from the colleges conduct a search for a dean and then provide the president or provost with an unranked list of the leading candidates. However, the discussion that accompanies that list makes clear who the first choice candidate really is, and typically that candidate is selected, because remember, there's no reason for the president or the provost to try to get the faculty of a college up in arms against him or her. Once in office, the dean's primary responsibilities in universities, especially in universities that operate as TUBs, are fundraising and external relations. And if a dean is successful on these dimensions and retains the support of the faculty, it is difficult for a provost or a president to penalize the dean, including in this extreme case, removing him or her from office, for failing to cooperate in university-wide initiatives. Deans thus have very little incentive to cooperate in activities that they do not perceive of as being in the best interest of their colleges. Now, the limited ability of the center to influence behavior of deans was clear to me both from my experiences as an administrator in Cornell, and when in recent years the presidents of Columbia and Georgetown tried respectively to remove a dean and to not reappoint a dean. Columbia president tried to remove the dean of Columbia College. The Georgetown president announced that he was not going to report to reappoint the dean of the Georgetown Law School. At both universities, pressures from alumni and key trustees, including the threat of withholding funds, caused the presidents to publicly rescind their decisions. I know about these things only from reading the Chronicle of Higher Education. I don't have any inside sources. And one wonders if the two presidents had failed to follow perhaps the most important advice that a president can be given: never make a major decision on campus that will eventually rise to the level of the trustees without first obtaining the trustees' support for those decisions. Okay, so let's turn to our final topic, which is what can the selective private institutions do to help control their costs? These institutions have been raising their tuition levels on average by 2 to 3% more than the rate of inflation for at least a century. Now, you might ask, is that bad? Okay, should we be concerned about it? Derek Bach said to me he has no apologies for raising the tuition at Harvard as much as he has, as he did when he was president. In fact, he wishes that he had raised tuition more, because the more resources Harvard had, the more good things that Harvard could do. Well, that's nice, but it's not just the donors and the students who are paying for what we do at these universities, it's the public. And even if we leave out financial aid and support for research, we have to realize that we, the selective institutions, as well as all of our educational counterparts, receive tremendous subsidies through three things. One, the fact that contributions to our endowments and gifts are tax deductible. Two, the fact that our endowment earnings, we don't have to pay any taxes on them. And three, the fact that we are exempt for local property taxes that are related to our educational activities. So what this means is there is an enormous amount of federal, state, and local tax revenue that is not being paid because of our presence. And it means that either the level of public services at each of these levels is going to be lower, or other taxpayers other than the universities are going to have to pay higher taxes. So as people realize, and legislators realize, that they are contributing to what we are doing, they increasingly examine what we are doing to make sure that we are still acting in the public interest. And so the argument for trying to moderate the rate of our tuition increase basically is an argument of trying to keep the external forces off of our backs. It's not an argument that says intuitively there's something bad with our prices always going up by more than tuition, as long as students are willing to keep and their families are willing to keep pay the bill. It is true, however, that if the universities as a group were ever to back off from their commitments to need-based financial aid and their accessibility to lower-income and moderate-income students went down, then we would be in deep trouble. And one of the major problems we face here is it doesn't matter what Cornell does, it matters what the selective institutions as a group does. So even if Cornell maintains its historic commitment, if other institutions are failing to do so, that may ultimately put pressure on the political system. Okay, so what can we do if we want to hold down cost? Actually, it requires actions from the federal and state government as well as from the institutions, and here I'm going to discuss only institutional policies. First, as my discussion of the differences between governance at public and private institutions indicate, the trustees of the private institutions are the key actors. If efforts to moderate tuition increases at private universities are to come, they must be led by the trustees. Absent strong pressure from the trustees, it is difficult for a president or a provost to advocate such policies. Secondly, the selective universities should organize themselves for budgetary purposes in a way that gives these institutions, the center of these institutions, some control over resources and some levers to influence the behavior of college deans. If academic institutions are serious about the efficiency of their operations and controlling cost, pure tub models are not the way to go. What is in the best interest of the individual unit is not necessarily in the best interest of the university as a whole. And since central control over resources removes many of the incentives that units have to raise revenue and hold down their own costs, clearly what is better is variants of the models that I call tubs with franchise fee or activity-driven models. Third, college deans must be held responsible for the well-being of the institution as a whole, not just the institutional college. They have to view themselves as officers of the institution, not just officers of their college. And this should be an explicit part of their job responsibilities. And faculty and alumni connected with the colleges need to be educated to understand that this is an important requirement that is being placed on the deans. And then serious performance evaluations of deans and their administrative roles need to be held to reinforce this point. Fourth, trustees and the key alumni of the colleges need to be educated so they too understand that what is best for their college is not necessarily best for the institution as a whole, and that they need to think of the latter first and not just their college. Now, I'm not going to tell you some of the experiences that I went through because those are too personal with trustees, but the point I will make is that some trustees first and foremost are looking out for their colleges, and that's the college they came from, and that's not necessarily a great thing to do. It's a hard sell to explain to them that the well-being of the university as a whole should take first priority, but I think that it's something that the central administration can profitably devote time to. Fifth, the institution needs to conduct regular, serious evaluations of all aspects of their academic and non-academic activities to decide whether efficiencies can be achieved in any activity and whether it makes sense for the institution to simply stop doing any activity completely. Put another way, the institutions have to get themselves in the mindset of growing by substitution rather than growing by expansion. Now, this is very, very difficult. Faculty members legitimately gripe about participating in mindless program reviews that get filed away and appear to have no impact. So these evaluations have to be substantive, and there have to be some sort of resource flows that are connected with them. There is a trade-off between faculty collegiality and accountability, and serious types of evaluations within the university may reduce collegiality, but that may be a price that the selective private institutions have to pay for trying to be more accountable and holding down their cost. As a faculty member, the attitude that most of us have, and if there are faculty members in the audience during the discussion period, you can correct me if I'm wrong, is the basic faculty attitude is, I don't want to take any action that's going to be damaging to another department, because if I do that, sometime they may come after me. And so therefore, it's simple just to live and let live. And in that environment, it's very, very difficult to hold down cost. Now, finally, the institutions have to stress much more the sharing of academic and non-academic resources, both within units across campus and across institutions. There was an announcement earlier this year that Columbia, Yale, and the New York Public Library are building a single repository to house rarely used books of all three institutions. And that's just the tip of the iceberg of things that can be done. So they're going to be able to reduce their rare book collection by 2/3, since they will give duplicate volumes to other institutions. They will reduce the cost of storing and holding these books by 2/3. And of course, more sharing of specialized courses to students on several campuses simultaneously through the use of distant learning technologies is another example. Institutions are going to have to think very seriously about how do you expand cooperation with institutions that you are competitors with, because these are the institutions that make the most sense for us to collaborate on joint issues. Now, we already collaborate on a number of administrative fronts. For example, there is a joint development going on a large number of information systems for human resources, student services, libraries, development and alumni relations, sponsored programs, and financial systems. Numbers of universities are doing these in consortium. However, the universities now need to take the next step and ask if there are ways to share the basic administrative services across campuses to further achieve economies of scale and cost savings. For example, is it really necessary for each institution to have its own payroll department, or each institution to have its own purchasing department? Thank you. And I'd like to thank John Cheslot for handling the slides so well.